Right, we need to find 1 Kings and chapter 12, and we'll sort of read it bit by bit as we go. We won't read it straight away through, we'll read as we go. So we're keeping parallel as we go. Right, let's just do a little bit of background. So if we can have the first slide up, and I've turned this on. I've been assured it'll be all right. Anyway, we'll see. We'll see how we go. We'll just do a very quick little recap. Now, here is a map which has the Empire of Solomon on it. This great empire that stretched right to the far north. In fact, virtually touched the northern part of the River Euphrates, right the way through Syria, and went right the way down through Israel and through Judah and down into the Sinai Desert and down to Egypt. So it was a massive empire. And of course, in our studies, we found that the Solomon's reign was an incredibly prosperous reign. In many respects, on paper, a very successful reign. The people were very happy. They were very wealthy. They were quite content living in the land. And all overall seems, you know, really fine and okay, and as it went along. So let's just see. So here's this picture of Solomon at the height of his reign. Everything was really good. As we sort of went through the study, though, there were just a few little glimmers of little things that might not be quite so right. And that made us just become a little cautious that it wasn't sort of just a clean sweep of everything was absolutely fine and going so well. And you may remember when we got to the last study, chapter 11, and things were put in one chapter that went drastically wrong and pear-shaped very, very quickly. And it was mainly to do with Solomon, who had married this huge number of wives. Many of them were not Israelite ladies, but they believed in other gods. In other words, they were fools because they had turned God into some sort of representation of a piece of wood, a piece of stone, a statue, and were worshipping it. And Solomon's big sin, of course, was that he himself, to keep his wives happy, maybe he had a serious nagging factor, we don't know. If you had 1,000 wives or whatever, it could have been pretty bad on a bad day anyway. So he puts some of these idols and statues up to keep them quite happy and so on. But that's bad enough. But of course, the writer of 1 Kings did also comment that Solomon's heart became turned towards these gods as well, which of course was the most serious thing of all. So the recipe is set for serious trouble. And in that last chapter of our studies, a chap called Jeroboam is mentioned, who we are told met a prophet of the Lord, and this prophet called Ahijah. It's quite interesting when you look for pictures of Ahijah on the internet, it thinks it's Elijah or it's very muddled. This is Solomon with things going a little bit wrong. He meets this prophet, and the prophet actually takes off Jeroboam's cloak and tears it all up into pieces and throws the pieces, if you like, one side, and then picks up 10 of them and gives 10 pieces of this cloak back to Ahijah, saying that one day Jeroboam will rule over 10 of the tribes, which gives us a hint that something pretty terrible is going to happen to this great, huge empire. When Solomon finds out, he actually tries to kill Jeroboam, and Jeroboam has to flee to Egypt. So he's off the scene towards the end of that last chapter. Solomon reigns for about 40 years, long reign, and then, of course, he dies, and that leaves us to move on. So let's just turn to the passage. We'll just read a little bit together. Okay, it's on page 351, chapter 12. And if you look at the last sentence, or the last verse, about Solomon in the chapter before, then he rested with his fathers at Solomon and was buried in the city of David, his father, and Rehoboam, his son, succeeded him as king. And notice that it was a bit different from what had happened before. What had happened before, there had been plots, conspiracies, civil war, etc. There hadn't been a nice, simple, easy succession. But here, the writer tells us, Rehoboam ruled in his stead. So there's an easy, straightforward changeover of power from his father Solomon, who died, to his son, who takes over this massive, gigantic, wealthy, beyond one's dreams, empire. You see, those thoughts are easily lost when you start to read this, because these things aren't mentioned in this next chapter. And you think, oh, you know, they can't have all disappeared suddenly. But we'll see how very quickly things do change. Okay? Right. So, what does Rehoboam do? Rehoboam went to Shechem. Shechem's in the slightly northern part, the sort of more the Israel-type part. For all the Israelites had gone there to make him king. That's to officially recognize him as king. When Jeroboam, son of Nebat, heard this, he was still in Egypt, where he had fled from King Solomon. He returned from Egypt. So they sent for Jeroboam, and he and the whole assembly of Israel went to Rehoboam and said to him, "Your father put a heavy yoke on us, but now lighten the harsh labor and the heavy yoke he put on us, and we will serve you." Rehoboam answered, "Go away for 3 days, and then come back to me." So the people went away. So, up to that point, we're surprised by something. And we're surprised, actually, that this request, "Your father put a heavy yoke on us, but now lighten the," and the words, "harsh labor and heavy yoke." Now, we know that Solomon used a lot of labor for all this building and so on, but in the early chapters that we studied, that was never written about negatively, really. It wasn't sort of written about, oh, this is terrible, the people were sort of slaves and they were complaining and they had a miserable existence and so on. That wasn't mentioned by the writer in the first part. But as soon as you get to this chapter, you begin to see that there was quite a serious problem and quite a deep resentment from people. So again, it's another slight sign that towards the end of Solomon's reign, things did get progressively worse and out of kilter as far as God's will is concerned. And people obviously had been suffering under this very heavy burden. You found a picture of a yoke, there we go, to illustrate the term that's used, burden that's put over the top of oxen and so on. Well, they use that description. It's a heavy, heavy yoke. So there are some deep, there's a deep problem there. And another thing, going to Shechem to formally recognize him as king also gives us another little warning, things that have been going on. In the past, there had been difficulties between the tribes of Israel, going right the way back to Saul's day. And there had been this collection of what were described as the northern tribes, and then the southern tribes. Now David, they had united together under David, and they'd been united under David, and they had been united under Solomon. There hadn't been a problem. But Rehoboam going to Shechem just gives us a slight little sign that things, you've just got to tread a bit carefully, just to make sure that all the tribal leaders of Israel come along with him and properly acknowledge him as king, so that the transition will be nice and smooth. And it is these people who are speaking to him. The various elders and leaders of the nation are speaking to the new king. And they make a fairly reasonable request. We read that request, we thought, well, that's That's a fairly reasonable thing to ask. If people are actually suffering under slave labour and so on and so forth, it's a fairly, you know, it is a reasonable request, isn't it? And Rehoboam answered, "Go away for 3 days and then come back to me." So they went away. So he didn't answer them straight away, which is sort of a bit odd, really. But now, it's very interesting to speculate why he said, "Come away for 3 days." Did I need 3 days to think this one over? Was I not really sort of capable of making a very clear decision? It's rather interesting whether he was rather weak-minded or not. So they do go away and come back after the 3 days. Now, we also know that Rehoboam was about 41. So that's how old he was at this time. He's about 41. While they're away for the 3 days, Rehoboam then does two things. Let's read them. So, verse 6. Then King Rehoboam consulted the elders who had served his father Solomon during his lifetime. "How would you advise me to answer these people?" he asked. They replied, "If today you will be a servant to these people and serve them and give them a favorable answer, they will always be your servant." So simply if you say, "Well, yes, I will. I will lighten your load. I will make it easy for you. I will make, you know, I'll happily do that request for you." But Rehoboam rejected the advice the elders gave him and consulted the young men who had grown up with him and were serving him. And so he asked them, "What is your advice? How should we answer these people who say to me, 'Lighten the yoke your father put on us'?" So he rejects that counsel and then asks, I suppose, if you want a modern vernacular, his mates. Right? He consults his mates. The young men who had grown up with him replied, "Tell these people who have said to you, 'Your father put on heavy yoke on us, but make your yoke lighter.' Tell them, 'My little finger is thicker than my father's waist. My father laid on you a heavy yoke. I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions.'" Now, that's a little bit of a contrast, really, isn't it, to sort of the other advice. So he has that advice. So what's he going to do? Well, verse 12. 3 days later, Jeroboam and all the people returned to Rehoboam, as the king had said, "Come back to me in 3 days." The king answered the people harshly. Rejecting the advice given him by the elders, he followed the advice of the young men and said, "My father made your yoke heavy. I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions." So the king did not listen to the people, for this turn of events was from the Lord, to fulfill the word of the Lord had spoken to Jeroboam son of Nebat through Ahijah the Shilonite. So he gives them a very harsh answer. There's a whip. The scorpions is not actually running around picking up a scorpion and tying it on the end of a whip and then lashing someone with it. That would be distinctly dangerous, even to actually try to do it, let alone the whipping. It's meaning that though you were maybe whipped as slave labourers under my father, you're going to be whipped even harder with whips that have got sort of metal barbs stuck on the end to make your burden harder. That's what he was referring to, and that's what he sort of meant. So he rejected the advice. He didn't weigh up the matter. And it comes as quite a surprise that he says that. And I think we can only really conclude how utterly foolish and stupid that answer was. If you were becoming and have become king of this great empire, and to really have such a lack of understanding about people's needs, It really puts Rehoboam down as someone who was extremely foolish. It is such a stupid answer. It's really hard to understand why a king answered that way. But then the writer tells us that the Lord's hand was in it and behind it. As a result, there is a strong reaction, as you would expect. And to show how stupid the answer was, it is obviously quite aware that Rehoboam wasn't really aware of the consequences of what a sort of his reaction could actually happen. It seems extraordinary that he's there with Jeroboam, and no doubt he knew something about Jeroboam, because his father had tried to kill him, and yet he was still showing no logic, no sense at all. So what do the people do? Verse 16. When all Israel saw that the king refused to listen to them, they answered the king, "What share do we have in David? What part in Jesse's son? To your tents, O Israel, look after your own house, O David." Basically, they're saying, let's go home. We're going home. So the Israelites went home, but as for the Israelites who were living in the towns of Judah, Rehoboam still ruled over them. So what basically happens is that the 10 tribes of the north, the larger part, I think we've got a map here somewhere, there we go, the larger part of the north rebelled against the authority of the king and broke away from his authority. And a northern kingdom was established. First of all, Jeroboam starts to fortify Shechem, which is just south of Samaria there, and Samaria eventually becomes the long-term capital, but Shechem initially becomes the capital, which he fortifies because, of course, he senses trouble. In the south, Rehoboam still has the largest tribe of all. In fact, the tribe was nearly as large on its own as the 10 tribes of the north, massive tribe of Judah, and also one other that they're referred to here. We'll come to that in a minute. We'll come back to that in a moment. So the people actually rebelled. Now that is quite serious, because it means that this great and prosperous empire has now split in half. And in fact, there's no more reference of prosperity and things going really well and so on. That all just disappears. And it may be one of the reasons why so much of Solomon's wealth and prestige just eventually, quite rapidly, just vanished. It's a reminder not to lay too much of our treasures here on earth. It all went and all disappeared very, very quickly. Right, well, if that's not bad enough, I think Rehoboam does another really silly thing. Let's just look at this. Verse 18. King Rehoboam sent out Adoniram, who was in charge of forced labor. So he actually sent to the tribes in the north Adoniram to enforce the forced labor, to enforce what he said, that I'm going to make it harder. Okay. But surprise, surprise, but all Israel stoned him to death. King Rehoboam, however, managed to get into his chariot and escape to Jerusalem. So even more astonishingly, Rehoboam had gone along with his main slave taskmaster, seemingly oblivious to how angry the people of the north were. Not wise. Not wise action. So Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. Now, when the writer sees the word "to this day," he's telling us that this was written before the eventual destruction of Israel a couple of hundred years later. When all the Israelites heard that Jeroboam had returned, they sent and called him to the assembly and made him king over all Israel. Only the tribe of Judah remained loyal to the house of David. And when Rehoboam arrived in Jerusalem, he mustered the whole house of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin, 180,000 fighting men, to make war against the house of Israel and to regain the kingdom for Rehoboam, son of Solomon. But the word of the Lord came to Shemaiah, the man of God, say to Rehoboam, son of Solomon, king of Judah, to the whole house of Judah and Benjamin, and to the rest of the people, this is what the Lord says, do not go up to fight against your brothers, the Israelites. Go home, every one of you, for this is my doing. And then quite surprisingly, and I do find it quite surprising, so they obeyed the word of the Lord and went home again as the Lord had ordered. So finally, Rehoboam does use a little bit of common sense and a little bit of wisdom and goes home. However, in future days, there is war between Israel and Judah. And the tribe of Benjamin is mentioned there, which is the missing one out of the 10, and the one, another one is out 10 to 12. And Benjamin was a very small tribe by then, and they lived around Jerusalem. That's why they're sometimes described as northerners, but they stayed with Judah in the south. So that's your two tribes in the south and 10 in the north. And if you want to, at some point, verse 20, if you want to read verse 20 again, we won't do it now, no time. Verse 20 is a bit of a problem in the way it's written. And I'll leave you to work out why it's a little bit of a problem the way it's written. There is a meaning for it, but a bit problematic. So, finally, Rehoboam does do what he's told. Now, Rehoboam had been terribly foolish. His utter foolishness had wrecked this wonderful kingdom, the biggest empire that Israel had ever had. And it all ends in quite a sort of catastrophe, and it's all gone. That can go off now, by the way. All right, thank you. So, is there a lesson for us in this? Well, there is something we can draw out of this, obviously, and it affects really very much our lives today, and particularly living in this country of ours, the country that we belong to, in the country where we have seen so much change in recent times. Now, we are living in a country that is totally and utterly obsessed now with political correctness. It's the dominant thing. It dominates everyone's thinking, and it causes the most incredibly stupid, use the word again, foolish actions as a result. But those actions are also far more serious. We're not talking about just the things that we sort of go, oh, political correctness, they just think they're so stupid and silly. You know, like they're not going to put one of the Tom and Jerry cartoons, His Mouse Friday, in the new Blu-ray set because little Jerry blacks himself up as a native on this desert island. Well, we can't have that. So it's not even going to be included in the new Blu-ray set, which is how stupid. But it has far more serious consequences for our nation. You see, this book by John Benton, Christians Living in a PC World, is really very, very interesting reading. And I've used some of the thoughts that came from it, because I was sort of reading it as I was committed to do this, and then I suddenly sort of put the two together. And he says our country is actually in a grand experiment to see what life is like when we ignore God and say that he doesn't exist. And that's what we're seeing in our country today. We're in this grand experiment that God does not exist, and how we can get on perfectly all right without him. And it's true to say the majority of people in this country are convinced that God doesn't exist or counts for nothing in their lives. And this process has been going on particularly since the 1960s, the nation has come to a decision that we don't need God anymore. And there are many reasons for that. Most people, not all, but most people have somewhere to live, so we're all right there. Most people have a car so they can get themselves around. Most people have a certain amount of money, so that's all right. Most people can go to the National Health Service if they get ill, and they can sort them out. And of course, if we have a very bad, dull, down day, then we've got a mountain of entertainment to keep us happy with the television or whatever. So we can do all those things and circumvent God in the process. What do we need God for? That's the sort of the pervading problem. And John Benton says that we've been running like this for about half a century, for about over 50 years now, and now the results are really coming in as a result of this experiment that we've been running in this country. And you see, that's exactly, that's what struck me so much, that's exactly what Paul is writing about in Romans chapter 1. If we just turn back to that passage. From verse 18, just that little bit there. But so, and when we look at our country, we can see how this experiment is going. And if you're a Christian, I'm sure you don't think it's going that well. But we can see how the experiment is going, and we can see what is going on all around us, and we can see the effects of what is going on all around us. For those people that say that we need to live in a secular, totally godless society, that's okay. That's okay today. That's what people will say, and that's what people think. And it's interesting that certain humanists and atheists actually believe through this that you can have a decent and a moral and upright society that can come through that. Now, that thought is completely stupid, but that's what many humanists and atheists believe. You can actually find that sort of society through kicking God out of it. They believe that, but that is just completely and utterly stupid. I mean, we know very well that that's not been the result of the society in which we live. We don't live in a decent, moral and upright society because people have dumped God out of the equation. That's absolute nonsense. When we see continuing incidences of family breakdown and difficulties in that, then street violence, drug abuse, and so on, we can go on with a great long list of prisons at bursting point, just to name a few. It's Romans 1 in action. We can just see it before our very eyes as people who thought they were so wise have just become fools and totally lost the plot. I mean, Romans 1:21 and to 23 actually says quite clearly that it is foolishness is a result of not believing in God. It is complete and utter foolishness. And if you read that thinking that Paul was just writing about ancient tribes, you know, worshipping statues and spirits in the darkest jungles and so on and so forth, it applies as much today as it did when Paul wrote it. It's just we have different types of spirits and idols which we, shall we say, trust in and focus on entirely. Like people can become totally and utterly obsessed with their career or get a great buzz about fiddling around with technology and so on. These things can fill their lives, anything that can fill their lives, but not God. And doing that is just living a life that doesn't make sense. Really, it doesn't make sense at all. Remember, if you and I want to be truly wise, then it is the truth of the Bible that we need to follow. Without God's truth, there are no answers to why we exist. You can listen to answers on the news every other day with a new so-called find to try and explain this, but we know that it's all nonsense. It is the truth of the Bible that tells us why and how we exist. Without God's truth, then, of course, if we take that away, there is no truth. There is no truth in this world. And that's what many atheists say. There is truth, or what is truth? They would say that all viewpoints are equally valid, they're equally the same, but this again is utter rubbish. Now, to conclude, I'm just going to read a few words from the author of the book by Douglas Copeland, I think it is, Life After God, where he described the effect of atheism. This, you know, there is no truth, there is no God, we can live life without it, had on him, which John Benton actually quotes to him. I'm going to just read it to you because it's rather extraordinary, really. So here's a man who's been living that life, the life which we would consider as foolish. And he says here, "Now, here is my secret. I tell it to you with an openness of heart I doubt I will ever achieve again. So I pray that you are in a quiet room as you hear these words." Well, we are. "My secret is that I need God, that I am sick and can no longer make it alone. I need God to help me give, because I am no longer seen capable of giving, to help me to be kind, as I am no longer capable of kindness, to help me love, as I seem beyond being able to love." Isn't that extraordinary? The impact of an atheistic life upon him. It had a very dramatic effect on him. If we come to trust in the Lord Jesus Christ, so that the one who knows the sense of forgiveness and a true purpose in life, if we come to know that, then that surely is the wisest act that we could ever make in our lives. Now, we will continue to see the experiment going wrong all around us. Yet we know that God's will is in that also. But we can, you know, it drives us and helps us to trust and continue to trust in him for the future. We don't want to be foolish like Rehoboam was, or like the man in the parable who built the house upon the sand, which is so often used as a children's story, but I don't think Jesus meant it as a children's story. It has a very, very, very serious message for us. We need to get smart. And we don't need to get smart by passing hundreds of GCSEs or A-levels or degrees or PhDs or anything else you'd like to fetch. We get smart by learning what is in here. We get smart by learning God's truth. It is God's truth that guards you and me from foolishness, from stupidity, from the really serious things in life. It guards us against such things. Oh, that we need to make this the central part of our life and our learning. You think about the things that we learn through our lives. We need to learn what God's truth says to us above anything else, and then we will be truly wise. Well, let's pray that the Lord will help us to do that and continue to do that, because it's a process that none of us here will ever finish while we're here on earth, because there is so much in here we can never, ever study and know it all. So it's an ongoing work. We don't need to stop and say, "Well, I've done it now." No, we haven't. We haven't done it anywhere near. We must keep on so that we will be truly wise and not foolish. And that will help us to face the things of this world as it continues to swirl around us. And we'll continue to do so. But then take encouragement. Use the words in prayer earlier about being on the victory side. It's not a cliche. It is the truth. Whatever happens, we know that we have a Saviour who died for us, who achieved for us, if we trust in him, a place in heaven in eternity. Well, if we believe that, then we are truly wise. We need to hold to that truth and not be stupid like Rehoboam.